Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hello and welcome to our very special 200th episode of Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard, and by very special episode, I mean we are so not going to do a big clip show or a sentimental retrospective set to that song by Green Day or anything like that. I mean, come on folks, 200, nice round number, but it's still just a number and we've still got lots to talk about in Canadian agriculture this week. Now we're going to start off this week in Alberta, where the provincial government has been reassessing its role in the farm sector and farmers there can expect significant change ahead. Jennifer Blair is a reporter with Alberta Farmer Express, and she's been covering these issues for you. Jen, hello and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Thanks so much for having me.
And just to start off, I remember when I first started working in this business back in the 90s, you know, I was trying to get an idea of how the different provincial ag departments worked and what they did. And, you know, I always seemed to get the impression from people who'd been in the business a while that Alberta sort of had the, you know, kind of the Cadillac model of provincial ag administration and extension and whatnot, at least in by Western Canadian standards. You know, I'm trying to get a sense now of, was that actually, you know, the case? I mean, had farmers really had any complaints, at least up until recently, with the level of service that was available through the ag department?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure that these changes were ever really about farmer concerns about service levels. You know, there were some challenges and I guess justifiable complaints with the regime change when the NDP were elected. But I think On the ground level, farmers have generally basically appreciated the service and support that they get from Alberta agriculture. You know, the ministry really has always had, you know, knowledgeable, skilled folks who've been a great resource for farmers. So you're probably not wrong in saying that it has been the Cadillac model. But, you know, when the new UCP government announced their budget cuts, we knew that agriculture was going to have to take some hits as well. And so one of the ways that they're doing that is by transitioning out of conducting research.
I mean, it's been pretty obvious that the province's revenue model has been a casualty of the pandemic, and cuts were expected. I mean, we'll talk about ag research in a sec, and you know, but what can you tell us about the other services that are being cut back first, and along with the staff who provide them?
So at this point, we know that the Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry is abolishing 247 positions, and 190 of those are on the agriculture side. So within that, the biggest cuts are to the primary agriculture division, which includes things like research, the plant and bee health surveillance program, some cuts to ag service boards, the environmental and farm stewardship program, the irrigation and farm water branches, the crop assurance extension and farm safety programs. But some other divisions will see some hits as well. We're going to see some reductions at the Food Science and Technology Center in Brooks, for example, and the Food Processing Development Center in Leduc, you know, as well as some, you know, kind of operational or administrative layoffs as well.
Oh my gosh. So what are you hearing about what these changes will mean at the the front facing level, at the farmer level?
I think that the most obvious casualty of that is the Ag Info Center, which was a call center here that farmers could call to speak to livestock, crop, and farm management experts. So that was a hugely great resource for farmers, and farmers really loved that, I think. But the center has been shut down, and the staff were laid off back in the spring. So I think beyond that, the biggest change has been to the government research model with the introduction of this new organization, Results-Driven Agriculture Research, which essentially is an arm's length organization that will now be heading up farmer-led research in the province.
Mm-hmm. And I've been seeing the announcements not only from the province, but also from the you know, the schools and the other orgs that are going to be taking over these research programs. But can you recap briefly where the provincial research is going per se?
Yeah. So aside from the creation of ARDAR, which will be managing, you know, its own ag research programs in Alberta, the provincial government has started to transition some of its ag research programs and some of the staff associated with them to post-secondary institutions in the province. So, you know, the University of Alberta is going to be taking on 4 government research programs and their researchers, while Olds College will be managing the barley program that was previously operated out of the Fieldcraft Crop Development Center in Lacombe. Down in southern Alberta, the University of Lethbridge is going to be taking on three programs, and the Lethbridge College will be taking over the Alberta Irrigation Technology Center and the Brooks Greenhouse. So those programs and some of their staff, well, will be... we believe will be transitioned into these post-secondary institutions, but we're not 100% sure what that's going to look like.
Does it sound so far like the bulk of the research staff, you know, the actual people who are doing the work, are going to be following these programs to their new respective overseers?
So I can't say for certain. You know, like the government layoffs are all pretty hush-hush, aside from the numbers. But, you know, I have heard anecdotally that some will be moving on to post-secondary institutions. And, you know, I've heard others that are worried that they're not going to have a job when the final round of layoffs is completed. So, you know, I think that that is really one of the key concerns here, is that no one really knows just yet how it's all going to shake out. But it does look like there is going to be kind of a net loss of research capacity within the province as these researchers kind of shift and move on. You know, Alberta's post-secondary institutions are also facing budget cuts and layoffs.
Yes.
So I can't really see that it would be possible for all of the government research staff to transition into that system. I know that some of the key researchers are going to be going into the post-secondary system, but I also know that other key researchers have been laid off. So it sounds like there will be a lot of knowledge and skill that's being lost here. And I think that's probably particularly true for smaller acre crops. And I think that, you know, people who are conducting research in the province, you know, the applied research associations are pretty concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your piece on the matter, just looking at the transitioning of research to these other organizations, you know, it sounds like the new catchphrase for research is, you know, is farmer led. You know, I'm trying to get a better sense of where the farmer led aspect comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think one of the challenges around the term farmer led is the implication that farmers haven't really been involved in ag research in the province in the past. And that's not the case. You know, farmers have always been involved, you know, in the boards of Alberta's commodity groups and in the applied research associations and the other research bodies that conduct research in the province. And, you know, all of those organizations have always worked really closely with provincial researchers over the years to set research priorities. But, you know, at the same time, there have been some concerns or worries in the past that the government is setting the research agenda, and that perhaps the research agenda doesn't really address the challenges and opportunities on the farm level. You know, farmers have been worried that research dollars are being spent on, I guess, ideological research rather than research that will actually solve problems on the farm. So I guess ARDAR's approach isn't necessarily new, but I think they're hoping that it will help producers feel like their voices are being heard. They're going to get some new ideas, and hopefully the research that will be conducted will actually be useful to farmers on their operations.
Mm-hmm. Now, just looking at what we know so far, of course, it is too early to say in some respects, but has there been any pushback on all these developments, you know, the Ag Research, the Ag Info Center, the other cuts that are coming? Has there been any pushback, or is it too soon to say, other than just to wait and see?
I think that everyone involved, you know, farmers and research groups included, are trying to stay kind of cautiously optimistic about the changes. The research groups in particular have raised a few flags around things like research capacity, operational funding, and knowledge transfer. But I think generally they're hopeful about the process so far, and that the details will be ironed out, and ultimately that this will be a positive direction for Alberta's agriculture industry. But I mean, it's kind of like you said, time will have to tell on this. So I guess for now, we'll have to wait and see.
I guess we will. Jennifer, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Me too. Jennifer Blair is a reporter with Alberta Farmer Express. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Next up now, we're going to have a closer look at fall fertilizer management in a special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Here you'll be listening to Grain News editor Carrie Belanger talking with Nutrien agronomist Christy Preston.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carrie Belanger, editor of Grain News, and I'm here with Christy Preston, who has a PhD in soil fertility and is a senior agronomist with Nutrien. Today, we're taking a closer look at the relationship between organic matter, soil types, the availability of sulfur to your crops, and how much sulfur you need to apply and when. Welcome, Christy. Thanks so much for being here today.
Good morning, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Christy, would you explain the relationships between organic matter and plant available sulfur?
So what farmers need to know is the majority of sulfur that's in the soil is present as organic matter, but that organic matter has to be broken down before those nutrients are plant available. So organic sulfur has to be converted to sulfate before it's plant available. But a lot of times a farmer might not necessarily see sulfur deficiencies in his field because he has high organic matter. So say above 3% organic matter, a lot of times we don't see sulfur deficiency.
So are there soil test methods for determining sulfur availability?
Some states here in the U.S. do have recommendations of sulfur application rates based on soil tests, but for the most part, they're not highly recommended because sulfate sulfur is mobile within the soil profile. Now, Kansas in particular requires, say, a profile or a 0 to 24 inch sample, and I think it's around 6 parts per million is the cutoff point to where you need applications. But again, since sulfur is so mobile within the soil profile, it's hard to pinpoint how much sulfur is actually needed using a soil test method.
So what should farmers focus on instead?
We recommend that farmers focus on uptake rates and removal rates within the harvested portion of the plant.
Could you explain these terms for us?
Yeah, so they're completely different. The amount of uptake that a plant needs to maximize yield or to reach a certain yield level is a lot higher than what's being removed in the plant, in the plant portions that are being harvested. So grain or tissue in some crops. So the difference between the two is the nutrients that are going to be recycled into the soil. So you've got the total amount taken up, then you've got the amount removed, and then you will have some portion of the nutrients that were taken up that will be recycled. However, we need to focus on those nutrients that are leaving the field, that are removed in, say, grain or tissue harvest. So both the uptake values and the removal coefficients are used to calculate something that we call the harvest index. Now, this gives a farmer an idea of the portion of uptake that is being removed. So say for a corn crop that is producing 230 bushels per acre will take up around 23 pounds of sulfur, but will remove about 13 pounds. And so the calculated harvest index is about 57%. And what that tells a farmer is that 50% of the sulfur that is taken up within the plant is going to be removed at harvest time. And that should give the farmer an idea of how much needs to be applied, because we at least want to apply what is being removed from the soil.
What about, how does the crop's need for sulfur vary during the growing season? Because that will also have an effect, will it not?
It will. Some research has shown that 50% of the sulfur taken up occurs after the plant enters reproductive phases. So say a canola field that has just reached flowering might begin to show some sulfur deficiencies because it's increasing the amount that it's taken up. And if there's not enough sulfur applied, then that plant is going to show those deficiency symptoms. But again, if the organic matter is high enough, those soil temperatures are going to be high enough that that organic matter will be breaking down some and supplying sulfur. But a lot of times, farmers need to apply supplemental sulfur using fertilizers.
I see. So how can farmers manage this timing of the sulfur needs of the crop?
The best thing a farmer can do is to ensure that there is some sulfur available early in the growing season, but then also make sure that there is some sulfur available later in the growing season whenever the crop's taking it up the most. Now, Nutrien has a new product, Smart Nutrition Mat Plus MST, where the sulfur is present as an elemental form, so the oxidation process to make sulfate sulfur plant available will take a little bit of time. So the fertilizer acts as a slow-release sulfur source. So we suggest that farmers maybe apply something like ammonium sulfate to ensure early season availability, and then have that prolonged availability with the elemental sulfur in MAT plus MST.
Thanks, Christy. That really makes sense. Now, what if farmers or agronomists want more information? Where can they find it?
More information can be found at smartnutritionmst.com.
Thanks so much, audience, for listening to this special feature sponsored by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST from Nutrien. And thank you so much, Christy, for being here with us today.
Thank you, Carrie.
You've been listening to Grain News editor Carrie Belanger talking with Nutrien agronomist Christy Preston. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. If you're somehow still able to do fall field work right now, you might very well be listening to this show on the tractor, and depending how the day is going, you might be wondering to yourself, self, aren't those self-driving tractors supposed to come along any day now and replace me at this job? It's not as though the technology isn't out there. If you've followed our next guest's articles over the past few years, you'd know it's not a question of if, but when. Mind you, though, when is still a very big question. Scott Garvey is the machinery editor emeritus for Grain News and Country Guide, and he's on the line now. Scott, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Good to be back with you, Dave.
Just to bring everyone up to speed, you weren't dreaming it, folks. Scott did retire, but is still doing some writing for us. And Scott, in your latest article in Country Guide, we can see the pictures of Case IH and New Holland's visions for autonomous tractors, and we know that John Deere has been working on the same. Where are the majors now, first off, on autonomous tractor technology?
Aside from John Deere, we haven't heard a lot from the majors, and those images that appear in Country Guide are a couple of years old now, when CNH made a big splash with the autonomous cabless Magnum and its partner in the New Holland line. John Deere introduced a new module, I believe they called it, at Agritechnica last year, electric tracked power unit, basically, that's designed to pull conventional implements. But really, the news in this segment in terms of autonomy is coming from small players, that names that we've probably never heard before.
Mm-hmm. From the majors' end, though, just what's been the holdup at their end?
I think it's still the same thing. It's safety, liability. They've got an established business with tractors that require a warm body in the seat, and they're still playing, and that's still their bread and butter, and they're sticking with that. As far as autonomy, my guess is they're going to go ahead and let these small players break into the segment, and then as we've seen with John Deere buying Blue River Technologies a couple of years ago, once the technology's there and established, it makes sense not only for the majors to buy these smaller companies that have broken ground, so to speak, in this new field, but it also makes sense for those smaller companies to sell to the majors and the owners to cash out there from their technology investment.
So it's not only a chance, but a possibility, a probability that some of these upstarts that you profile in your article might actually get out ahead of the majors in this specific market?
Right. The only real active advancement other than that John Deere announcement a couple of years ago comes from AGCO with their Zaver project, which is the swarm technology. They had a major global press conference about a month, October, I guess it was. And they introduced version 2 of the Zaver, which is totally different than if you saw version 1, but still the small, under 200 kilogram machine designed to work in swarms. But really, we're kind of seeing the majors, other than that effort, sit back. And actually, John Deere bought another technology company just a few weeks ago, or they announced it a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Now we've talked before, on this show and in our various print books about dot technology as well, like Canadian Prairie Company that's now owned by Raven Industries out of South Dakota. They've been bought up as well, but it looks as though Raven also has sort of eased off the gas pedal on bringing that system to retail sale.
Yeah, that's another example of a larger corporation picking up a smaller company that's out front in the technology field with Raven buying Dot. When Raven bought Dot, they put commercialization on hold. Dot had actually sold around a half a dozen, I think, units on a special introductory sort of program to some select producers. Raven has been working on a autonomous grain cart project, which they say will be introduced shortly. And it looks like the Dot machine fit nicely into that overall autonomous program that Raven had been working on. I spoke to some Raven people a few months ago, and they have not established a firm date yet for when they will relaunch the commercial effort of Dot, but they say everything is on track. One of the people I spoke to said this could go right now, but we're just kind of dotting our I's and crossing our T's and just making sure everything's good to go for when the official relaunch of the commercial project or the commercialization begins.
And apart from just the navigation and whatnot, we've seen, of course, the video of the Dot machines and their capabilities. You know, apart from straightforward navigation too, I gather, and at least from your article as well, that there are other companies, and again, far from just the majors, who are also still working on the sensing end of the equation. You know, what can you tell us about that?
Got lots of those, I don't know if I should say lots, but there are some of the technology companies that are still creating new sensors. We see even Google in on the business now with their mineral project, they call it, which is incorporating a variety of new sensors. Google came out with a press announcement not too long ago to emphasize the mineral project, which is hand in hand with their Google self-driving car project. They were kind of long on marketing and short on specifics as to what exactly is new and wonderful about mineral that we aren't seeing elsewhere. So that's a project in R&D. We're seeing a company called Hexagon, which just had a big public day. And they're more of a supplier to the majors in terms of new technologies and sensors. And they're working on they have a program now that allows the sensors to detect human presence, which is a big step up in safety requirements, something that the majors have been concerned about for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first fully commercialized units are going to probably have that as well. And, you know, you've touched on the liability issue and whatnot, you know. Obviously, the first units that actually do make it to market, I mean, they're going to have a whole bunch of different types of sensors, I would imagine. I mean, not to be able to just sort of, you know, to see through dust, but whatever other weather obstructions are out there, but also to be able to tell when they're going to hit a person or, you know, hit a moose or, you know, and as well as, you know, just other obstacles like a rock or a bush or a tree or what have you.
Right. And I remember a John Deere executive saying to me, well, imagine you're driving on a mountain highway and your autonomous vehicle sees a human out front and there's a cliff to the left. What does it decide to do? Hit the human and save your life or drive over the cliff and save the human's life? That's one of the technology questions that has been bouncing around in the majors. This human sensing technology from Hexagon is important in that way. And of course, having a variety of different sensor types and cameras has been something that a lot of people in R&D in that field have been telling me is necessary, because when you go off-road, you have dust as a major factor that clouds typical camera views. So if you're driving down the highway on a clear day, you don't have that problem. But when you go into the off-road sector, you do. Interestingly, though, I just saw some information come from a Russian company in which they're saying they're using, they're coming up with a whole new autonomous system that they've started with combines, and they're using only one camera. Now, they haven't addressed how they've gotten around this dust problem, but they're saying their system does have human identification, and it allows the combine, and this is kind of a new track for this technology. It doesn't rely on GPS. The camera itself provides the guidance. So you would never have to worry about losing a GPS signal and your machine stopping in the field. This actually does or would make a machine completely autonomous. It works on its own. It detects the crop edge, even in down crops, they say. It knows what to do to come across unexpected hazards, which is another advantage over GPS, because GPS just tells you where you are in the field and assumes you've plotted the map incorrectly with all the hazards. This detects anything unexpected. Having said that, I've talked to some other people in North American manufacturing in the ag sector, and they say, well, we're always a little bit skeptical of hearing new technology coming out. Russia, kind of in the same vein as the Russia announcing they had a vaccine ready to go a couple of weeks ago, and turns out, not so much. But despite that reluctance, this Russian company says it's going to break into the North American market. This system is going to be available, and we'll see how that develops.
It'll be intriguing if true, definitely. Now, you'd mentioned before in your article too, just as far as getting past dust and whatnot, that there are sensors that are able to sort of get through dust. But of course, I mean, we're not dealing with something that's like strictly a visual system. There, of course, there'd be something different altogether, right?
Yeah, there are lots of R&D projects going on right now. Even the University of British Columbia, their student program is working on developing new types of sensors that will not only help with navigation, but help detect plants, like help the machine to understand what it's seeing rather than just follow a track and do a pre-programmed process. That's been the trend in the industry for a long time. I mean, I remember even several years ago, I was at a launch in Germany for Amazon, which really started the sprayer plant a recognition program when they came out with a sprayer that would detect, or it was kind of a prototype, I believe, at that stage, decide whether it wants to actually kill this plant or not. So, I mean, we've been going down this road for a long time. The technology is evolving, and there's just so much going on out there, but we're just yet to see that kind of come over the horizon and start making a really big impact on the commercial market.
Mm-hmm. And we'll leave it there because of my vested interest in making sure that people check out country-guide.ca rather for Scott Garvey's full article sometime in the very near future. Scott Garvey, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure, Dave.
Scott Garvey is a farm machinery writer and man of many talents and the machinery editor emeritus for Country Guide and Grain News. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard.
Well, commodity markets in the past week or so got a bit of a bump from news of a couple of companies having some early success in developing a vaccine against COVID-19. But for commodities, the other major motivator was the latest round of World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, or WASD, from USDA. Here to discuss all that and a whole lot more, we have Glenn Halleck from Glacier Markets Farm. Glenn, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Always. Now, let's start with the WASD report, which makes it out that there doesn't seem to be nearly as much crop to go around as many in the trade previously suspected.
Yeah, it's really quite fascinating. Back on November the 10th, the USDA came out with their latest supply and demand report. And, you know, pretty well everybody in the markets was expecting corn yields to go down, soybean yields to go down. And the USDA kind of pulls a fast one, and they brought in cuts to yields, production, and ending stocks lower than what anybody expected. That generated about a 15 cent per bushel boost to corn, and soybeans rose about 35 cents that day.
Wow. Okay. So has that held for the long term, at least as far as what we're seeing in prices right now?
Oh yeah, it's a big help. Soybeans, corn, other oil seeds like canola, they've been on the upswing since, well, pretty much since midsummer. They got a boost back in the end of September when the USDA released their stocks report, and there wasn't as much corn and soybeans as farmers thought, so prices went up again. And now, you know, with this report last week, you know, ending stocks for corn are going down, ending stocks for soybeans are basically going, well, if the predictions hold out, soybeans are going to be at their lowest point for ending stocks in about 6 or 7 years, like under 200 million bushels.
Wow. Okay. And what are we hearing from other soybean growing countries that, I mean, is this situation likely to continue for the near future?
Well, what we're looking at is despite the dryness in Brazil, and there's also dryness in Argentina, Brazil, a lot of the market analysts believe Brazil is still on pace for a crop of over 130 million tons, which would, you know, easily surpass any record.
Mm-hmm. Now, switching to another oil seed, of course, with canola, there was an interesting article a couple of weeks back where one analyst had expressed concern that the top might be in for the year. I was reminded of that partly because I'd tweeted out a link to it at the time, and just the other day I got a reply tweet back saying, "Yeah, Dave, your tweet there didn't age very well." Yeah. So what happened there?
Well, you know, canola prices, they're still on the upswing. Even today, they're up $2-3 per ton. In general, edible oils around the globe are on the upswing. So that's pulling up a canola. You know, talking with some guys, they're thinking, you know, right now we're around what $562-563 per ton for the January contract. Mm-hmm. We could see canola perhaps pushing to $575, maybe $580 per ton.
Wow. And, you know, even with China not currently taking a lot of our canola, I gather export demand is still a factor as well.
Yeah. Now, isn't that a surprise? You know, all that kerfuffle with China. Last year, we had more imports, canola exports than what was expected. And this year so far, we're about a million tons ahead of pace again. A lot of that, I believe, is going to Europe.
Wow. Okay. So I was just about to ask who's buying, but it's interesting that Europe's taking more to make up for the loss of the Chinese market.
Yeah, their rapeseed production is going down, so they're turning to Canada for our canola.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting too. I was just reading the other day, switching gears for a second, about barley. There was an interesting report just the other day referring to the amount of Canadian barley that China is taking as well, just because they've currently got prohibitive tariffs on their preferred supplier, Australia. Yeah. So that was a bit of a surprise as well to see those numbers.
Yeah, we do tend to focus on China for them not buying as much of our canola as they were. But, you know, if you look through those reports from the Canadian Grain Commission, like I was just speaking with a pulse trader today, and dry peas, like our exports to dry peas are sky high going to China right now. So be it, you know, China's problems with Australia, China's turning to us for barley, and, you know, they're looking at our peas. So, you know, in some aspects, our exports to China aren't that great. In other aspects, they're just fantastic.
And now there's also more reports coming out in the next few weeks that are going to sort of help move markets one way or the other. I was wondering what you could tell us about that.
Yeah, the International Grain Commission, they come out with their next supply and demand report on November 26th. It would be interesting to see which way those numbers in the report go, whether or not they cause any sort of major shakeup in the market. And then it's the for us here in Canada, it's the long-awaited principal field crops report from Statistics Canada coming on coming out on December 3rd. That's okay. Finally going to give us some insight as to what yields and production were this year.
Okay. And that's one thing that we haven't really seen. That's one thing we haven't really seen any or a lot of hard data from, at least as far as the Canadian crop is concerned lately, have we?
Yeah, there's been very, very little. You know, Stats Canada doesn't put out the reports like, let's say, as the USDA does. You know, they have their next supply and demand report coming out about a week after Stats Canada's report. So that that report too could maybe cause a few shakeups in the market.
So it's basically never a dull moment all around. Wow.
Oh, it's lots of fun.
Yeah. And, you know, here I thought, wow, you know, it looks like the harvest is just about done. We can all sort of relax now. Huh, no, there's more to come.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your time, Glenn. Thanks very much for your time on Between the Rows today.
Well, thank you, Dave. Always enjoy it.
Me too. Glenn Halleck is a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm in Winnipeg. I'd like to thank Glenn and our other guests, Scott Garvey and Jennifer Blair. That's all the time we have for this week, but we'll be back in a week with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. I'm your host, Dave Bedard. Thanks for listening.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.